Welcome to Quantum Field Theory 1. The goal of this course is to combine two of the most successful theories of nature we know of, namely quantum mechanics and special relativity. Now, as the title of the course suggests, the way we know how to do that, how to combine quantum mechanics and special relativity, involves fields. Why that is maybe not so obvious to you yet, so I want to spend the first part of the lecture providing some motivation for why, if we want to do this, if we want to combine these two very successful theories of nature, special relativity and quantum mechanics, we need to use fields. And there's several different reasons why we need fields in order to do this. And so the first answer I'll give to this question of why we need fields in order to combine quantum mechanics and special relativity is that, well, if we just try to do it without using fields, in particular, if we try in single particle quantum mechanics to just make it relativistic. So in single particle quantum mechanics, we can compute the propagator, and we'll do this in tutorial tomorrow. So we can compute the propagator. So this is the amplitude for a particle that's at the origin to propagate to some other position in a time interval t. And note that I'm using natural units here. So I'm set throughout the course, I'll set h bar and c equal 1, which is why there's no h bar here. This is a convenient set of units because they're natural units. We can always restore them if we want to work in familiar units like kilograms and meters and joules. But we can always restore them just by dimensional analysis. So up in this exponent, we've got h times t, which has the same units as h bar. So we know in the exponent, we should have a dimensionless number, and we can figure out what power of h bar and c we should need to insert to make this equation dimensionally correct in another system of units. So we can always do that. And I'll be working in these units for simplicity throughout the course. So we can compute this propagator. And what we would expect is that, well, if this single particle relativistic quantum mechanics is going to be a consistent theory, consistent with causality and special relativity, then this should vanish outside of the light cone. But what you'll find tomorrow in tutorial is that this is non-zero outside of the light cone. So this is relativistic, which means that H acting on a momentum eigenstate gives us root p squared plus m squared. So this is a problem. This is telling us that this is not the way we should proceed. We can't just take the single particle or even multi-particle quantum mechanics that you're used to and just try to force it to be relativistic by imposing by using a relativistic Hamiltonian. Oh, that doesn't work. And the reason why this fails is that basically particle number non-conservation is an essential part of quantum field theory. We can't really combine these two theories if we also demand particle number conservation. So if we have to choose between particle number non-conservation or faster than light travel, of course we'll choose particle number non-conservation. That's something that's very central to quantum field theory. And let me just give a brief motivation for why we expect in general that if we are trying to combine quantum mechanics and special relativity, we should expect that particle number is not conserved. And so to see that, and imagine we've got a cubic box with side length L. And quantum mechanics tells us that there should be some uncertainty in the momentum if we put a particle inside that box, which is, again, in natural units, greater than or about 1 over L, this size of the box. This is the box size. And this comes from quantum mechanics. But if we are working with a relativistic quantum mechanics, then we know that for large momentum, P should be approximately the same as E. If we make the box small enough, then relativistically, P should be about the same thing as E, which is the same as M. So this follows from special relativity. So if we make the box small enough, there should be some uncertainty in the mass of the particles in the box. And the way for that to work is if we have pair creation. So if we make the box small enough, then we could have great enough uncertainty in the momentum so that there's some probability that a pair of particles will pop out of the vacuum. So that's just a motivation, and we can make and we'll see more precise ways in which particle number is not conserved. But this this very quick line of reasoning shows you that it might not be reasonable to expect that particle number is conserved if we try to combine these two theories. So as long as 1 over L is much greater than M, then we'd expect energy uncertainty should be greater than 2m to give us pair production. So we don't expect particle number to be conserved. So that's one reason why we should use fields, because in quantum field theory, we can think of particles as excitations of a field, and as quantized excitations of a field, and we can have any number of those excitations, and so quantum field theory naturally incorporates particle number non-conservation. And so that's a first answer for why, when we want to combine quantum mechanics and special relativity, using fields is a natural way to do that. So there are two possible routes we could take in developing quantum field theory. One is we could start from some basic principles like quantum mechanics, special relativity, and it turns out to make any meaningful progress, we'd need to add some additional requirement on our theories, something involving locality or clustering, which is a way of saying that that distant experiments should be unaffected by what we're doing locally, or in other words, we can make measurements in our lab without needing to know what's going on in a distant galaxy. So if we wanted to start from first principles, we would need to add to the postulates of quantum mechanics and special relativity some additional requirement about locality.
What do you mean by not affected by distant galaxy? So what if we have some sort of quantum entanglement? Is it violate the clustering or not?
That doesn't violate. So this basically is saying that if we wanted to do some experiment in a lab, then we don't need to know what's going on in a very distant lab. So we don't need to measure everything in the entire galaxy in order to make a prediction about what's going on locally. We need to have just some local information, local in space-time. So we might need to know what's going on in some small region, maybe for some small amount of time in the past if we're just doing some experiment here. And exactly how much information we need depends on how precisely we want to measure that. And we won't go into the technical details of here, but without the point I just want to make is that we need to add something a little bit more than just these two in order to.
So if we have non-local effect, we will evaluate clustering. Is it right? That's it right?
That's right. So for example, if we had a So. If the force law didn't decay with the distance, but instead increased, that could cause a problem with that. And we would need to know what the charges of particles in a distant galaxy are in order to predict the experiment. So with these, so we could start from first principles and try to show that just assuming these things, we get quantum field theory. And this is the approach, for example, followed in Weinberg's book. It's not quite a proof, but he presents some fairly strong arguments that it's hard to get anything else other than a quantum field theory if you want a theory that is, in an appropriate sense, local and obeys the familiar properties of quantum mechanics and special relativity. Not quite a proof, but it's a fairly convincing argument. And then we could take a classical limit of quantum field theory to get a classical field theory. In this course, we're going to take the opposite approach. We're going to start with a classical field theory and so here's a classical limit. I'm going to go this way. I'm going to go from a classical field theory to a quantum field theory. We need a quantization procedure. And our starting point in this course is going to be from classical field theory. We'll see how to quantize that to get a quantum field theory. And then we'll explore how quantum field theories give us some of these properties. So we're going to start start over here and go this way, mainly because it's much faster. This step in particular is quite involved. But if you're interested, you can read about how to go this way in Weinberg. So one reason why we want to use fields is for particle number non-conservation. A second reason is related to the reason we use fields in classical physics, which is to avoid action at a distance. So for example, one of the motivations for introducing the electromagnetic fields was to avoid action at a distance, provide some physical mechanism by which a charge affects another charge. And that's another good reason why we should use fields in for trying to develop a quantum theory. Using fields also helps developing starting from a classical field theory means that the quantum field theory will inherit many of the locality and causality properties from the classical field theory, which will help us develop a theory that is appropriately local and satisfies special relativity. So there are a number of other things we get automatically from quantum field theory, or puzzles that quantum field theory explains that are unexplained in either in quantum mechanics or in special relativity alone. One nice thing that quantum field theory explains almost automatically is that identical particles are identical. Now this statement may seem tautological, but a priori, there's no reason why every electron in the entire universe has to have exactly the same mass and exactly the same charge and exactly the same spin. If we're just thinking about electron in quantum mechanics, there could be some distribution of charges of electrons. That's in principle something that we could have observed. We don't. As far as we can tell, every electron in the entire universe is exactly the same in all of its properties. And that's an automatic consequence of quantum field theory. Quantum field theory says that all electrons are excitations of a single electron field, which permeates the universe. So the fact that electrons all have the same charge, all have the same spin, all have the same mass is a automatic consequence of quantum field theory. So it explains with we don't even need to do any calculations to see that is a pre-consequence of quantum field theory. Another nice feature of quantum field theory that I'll explain in a sort of hand-waving way now, but we'll see in more detail later in the course, is it explains the existence of antimatter. So our understanding of how neutrons, so N here stands for neutron, and protons can scatter involves the exchange of a particle, a charged particle known as the pion. So here I'm drawing a sketch of the space-time history of this scattering event. Time is going in the vertical direction, and space is going horizontally. So here, this is describing a process in which a proton and a neutron are moving towards each other. They exchange a pion, and in the future, a neutron and a proton are traveling away from each other. So this is a scattering event mediated by the exchange of a positively charged pion. And as we'll see later in the course, we can describe scattering processes like this by exchanges of virtual particles. So here, a pion is absorbed by this proton, changing it into is emitted by this proton, changing it into a neutron, and over here it's absorbed. And these two points are space-like separated. And so you may be concerned about that point, but that's something we'll come back to. It doesn't turn out to be a problem. So this is how we can describe the scattering process in this frame. But if we boost, then we can boost to a frame in which the pion is absorbed by the neutron before it's emitted by the proton. In which case, in order for charge to be conserved, this has to be a negatively charged pion, because if it's absorbed over here, we've got a positively charged proton. It would need to be a negatively charged pion in order for the neutron to have zero charge. So this process, which involves a positively charged pion in another frame, must involve a negatively charged pion. And so if we want to be able to describe the physics in both frames, we need both positively and negatively charged pions. So antimatter is required to build a consistent quantum field theory. This is sort of just a sketch of why. This is a point we'll return to later in the course. And a third big triumph of quantum field theory is the spin statistics theorem. So the spin statistics theorem in quantum field theory says that integer spin particles have Bose-Einstein statistics. And half integer spin particles have Fermi-Dirac statistics. So this is something we can prove using quantum field theory. We won't go through all of this, but we will maybe see some hints of what will go wrong if we try to violate some quantum field theory. But in your undergraduate quantum mechanics courses, this was always just stated as an observational fact, that we observe that integer spin particles have Bose-Einstein statistics, and half integer spin particles have Fermi-Dirac statistics. It's a consequence of quantum field theory. If you try to combine special relativity and quantum mechanics in a consistent way, this follows. So that's a surprising and important consequence of quantum field theory. Okay, so the route we're going to take is we're going to start with a classical field theory and quantize this field theory to get a quantum field theory. There are two possible ways we can do this. So the first way is known as canonical quantization. And this is probably the first way that you learned about quantum mechanics, is you can take classical objects in quantum mechanics, would be the position and momentum, and promote those objects to operators. And we're going to do the same thing when we quantize, canonically quantize the classical field theory. We'll take some classical objects from the classical field theory and promote them to operators. So that's a valid way to get a quantum field theory. Another way, and this is the method we'll be exploring in this course, 51. And a second way we can go from a classical field theory to a quantum field theory is through path or functional integral quantization. Which you explored in the quantum theory course last month. And so that this is a method we'll explore in QFT2. So both methods have their advantages and drawbacks. Some computations or questions are easier to address in one or the other formalism. So as you might expect based on your experience in quantum theory, these two formulations of quantum mechanics look very different. But some questions are much easier to address in one formulation or the other. We'll see in this course that some questions about where do particles come from, what does it mean to be a particle are easy to address in a canonical quantization, as well as a number of exact results we'll discuss in this course that are easier to derive in the canonical formulation. The functional integral formulation also has its advantages. One of the biggest advantages is it's much easier to deal with non-abelian gauge theories. One example of a non-abelian gauge theory is the strong force. So the techniques we'll develop in quantum field theory one, they can address, can be used to study non-abelian gauge theories. It's much more difficult than using the methods we'll study in quantum field theory. So both methods are useful, we'll be focusing on this method in this course. We'll come back to the other method next month. Okay. And so our method that we're going to focus on is canonical quantization. So we need to promote some objects in the classical theory to be operators. And in quantum mechanics, you promote both the position and momentum to be operators. If we tried to do that in quantum field theory, we would already run into trouble. Because in quantum mechanics, x hat and t are treated very differently. So x hat is an operator, and t is a parameter. Now, if we're trying to develop a relativistic theory, it doesn't seem like a very good idea to treat time and space differently. One of Einstein's insights was that we should treat time and space in the same way. And, well, we don't do that in quantum mechanics, which is part of the reason it's not relativistic. And if we want to treat them in the same way, there's two possible routes we could take. So we could treat them both as operators. And, well, we could do that. One issue would be in the Schrodinger equation, we'd still need a time parameter to describe time evolution. So, well, we could use proper time. Tau. And that would work. The issue is that, well, that's not the only choice we could make. We could also use some function of the proper time. That should work as well. And if we did that, well, we could develop a theory where we've got some position four vector operator that's a function of proper time. And we could develop quantum field theory along these lines. It turns out to be very difficult to do so, at least significantly more difficult than the route we're going to take. And most of the difficulty comes down to properly understanding this reparameterization freedom for the theory, because we don't have to use proper time. We could use some appropriate function of proper time as well. And that leads to significant complications in developing the theory. But if you're developing a quantum theory along these lines, there's no reason you need to stop at a single parameter. You could have some x hat mu that's a function of not just a time parameter, but also a space parameter. And this is the one way to develop string theory. So string theory, basically, the one place you can start for string theory is by trying to construct operators like this. And for those of you who take the string theory elective course, you'll see more about this later in the year. So this is a possible route. Turns out to be complicated because of this reparameterization freedom. But there is another route. So instead, the route we're going to take is that we're going to, instead of promoting time to be an operator, we're going to demote position to be a parameter. So the advantage of this route is it's simpler. And a key thing to keep in mind is that position is a parameter or a label on the fields. So at no point in the course are we going to need or discuss a position operator. So we're going to think of position as just a label on the fields, not as the eigenvalue of some information operator. So that's a big change from what you're used to in quantum mechanics. And okay, so our goal for the first part of the course is going to be to calculate observables such as decay rates or cross sections, and I'll discuss more detail later what those are, at leading order in perturbation theory. It's going to be our central goal for the first part of the course. We'll briefly discuss what goes on beyond leading order and some things that are tangentially related to this goal, but our primary goal for the first 2 weeks of this course is going to be to learn how to calculate observables at leading order in perturbation theory, in particular in scalar field theories, in the simplest possible field theories. So where we're going over the next 2 weeks, and I'll say briefly about where we're going beyond that, is so today we're going to discuss some classical field theory. Tomorrow we'll discuss a free or non-interacting quantum field theory. We'll discuss what are cross sections and decay rates and how they relate to the quantities we can compute in quantum field theory. Then we'll spend two lectures how to compute matrix elements. These are the analog. So, for example, a propagator is a matrix element. It tells us how one quantum state can transition to another quantum state. So we'll spend two lectures learning how to compute matrix elements perturbatively. Then we will see a faster but equivalent way how to do the same computation using diagrams. And then in the final lecture, we'll have a discussion of what goes on beyond leading order. There's a lot of interesting physics that doesn't show up at leading order, and this will be sort of a preview for what to expect in QFT2, where we'll examine these issues in much more detail. And so this is my half of the course, and I will just focus on the simplest quantum field theories, scalar quantum field theories, which give rise to particles of zero spin. So scalar fields transform trivially under the Lorentz group, and they give rise to spin zero particles. And then in the last 2 weeks of the course, Gong will show how to generalize these ideas to fields that transform non-trivially under the Lorentz group, or particles that have non-zero spin. So that's very briefly where we're going over the next 2 weeks.
Is QFT describing entanglement in any ways, or is the formalism adapted to it?
So quantum field theory includes, we can take a limit of quantum field theory to recover non-relativistic quantum mechanics. So quantum field theory encompasses everything that quantum mechanics does as well. It's in a sense more general than ordinary non-relativistic quantum mechanics. I think there's some interesting questions about exactly how the relativistic part of it affects things like entanglement and quantum information. And there, some of the elective courses will address those topics, and there are people in this building working on that as well. So a few logistical comments before I resume. So first of all, lecture notes for each of the lectures will be posted in advance of the lectures. So lecture notes for today's lecture are already on the wiki. I have also posted a reading guide. If you would like to read some other references, it's not required, but if you want to, I've posted suggestions, two or three suggestions for each of the topics we'll cover, or different places you can read about the material we'll be covering in the course. We're not following any one textbook particularly closely, so those suggestions jump between a number of references. Although several of the references cover basically all the topics we're covering in a slightly different order. And a third logistical comment is, like in quantum theory, there'll be a number of short quizzes that will be emailed out to you, a few per week. So look in your email. The first one will be coming out later this morning.
I have a question. So when you take that route of considering both x and t as operators, doesn't the problem of that causality problem that we have in the blackboard above appear again? That having a non-zero propagator outside of the light cone?
So as we'll see in tutorial tomorrow when we do the calculation, one of the assumptions that goes into this result is basically that you're dealing with just single particle quantum mechanics. So you have to be, if you want to take this route, you have to be careful not to accidentally or implicitly or otherwise impose fixed particle number.
Okay.
So that that's a key ingredient in deriving this contradiction.
Anything about, like, if we're gonna get homework this week or like that? Are we gonna?
The first homework will be assigned on Friday and due a week from Friday.
Okay.
So the quizzes that will be due usually about a day after they come out. So the first one is very short and it's due tonight. So it should take 5 or 10 minutes. Okay. So our route for studying quantum field theory is starting with the classical field theory and quantizing it. And so this is in many ways going to be very similar to the quantization procedure you're used to in quantum mechanics. And we can think about a classical field theory as the continuum limit of a set of particles. So we can imagine we have a finite number of generalized coordinates. In the continuum limit, what we'll get is a classical field. So here, phi is the field, and an x with no ornaments, I'm going to, from here on out, use to indicate the four vector x. So this is both space and time. I'll sometimes separate out the time and space components. And when I mean the three vector x, I will indicate that with a vector symbol on top. And note that in the text lecture notes, this would be italic, the four vector, and this would be boldface, the three vector. So as I alluded to before, in our approach, we're going to be treating position as a label, as a parameter, not as an operator. And using this, so if we think of a quantum field theory as a continuum limit, where we have basically some number of particles that are moving around at each point in space-time, the index A, which indicates which of the particles we are talking about, becomes the spatial label or spatial argument of the field. And so keeping in mind this analogy, the fact that you can think of a quantum or a classical field as a continuum limit suggests how to generalize the equations you're familiar with from ordinary particle quantum mechanics to field theory. So in ordinary, if we're dealing with the classical theory of particles, the action is the integral over some Lagrangian, which usually depends on the position and velocity of the various particles. Can just use this analogy to see what kind of action we're usually considering. So instead of summing over the particle labels, the analogous thing to the particle labels A is the position. So we have to, instead of sum, we have to integrate. And our Lagrangian will, in general, are most typically just depend on the field and the derivatives of the field. And so the equation of motion, in this case, is just the variation of the action is zero, and analogously, in the field theory case, the equation of motion is that the variation of the action is zero. And so the conjugate momenta are the derivative of that, and analogously, the conjugate momenta here are the derivative of the Lagrangian density with respect to phi dot. So you've seen some of this in David's classical mechanics course, but just to remind you that if you are ever unsure of what the appropriate equations are for the field theory case, just by remembering this, the fact that you can think of a field is a continuum limit, and that the analogous thing to the particle label is the position, you can usually guess the right equations. So the simplest quantum field theory is a quantum version of the theory we're going to study next, which is known as Klein-Gordon theory. It's a scalar field theory, and the quantum version doesn't have any interactions, which makes it a very simple theory, both because there are no interactions and because it only involves a scalar field theory, which doesn't transform, transforms trivially under the Lorentz group. So it makes a particularly simple example to begin our study with. And the Lagrangian for this theory, this is the, you can take this as the definition of the theory, is it's the derivative of the field squared minus half m squared phi squared. And so we'll study the classical version of this theory today. And the solutions we'll find to the classical equation of motion today when we study this theory will be useful when we quantize the theory tomorrow. And a word on notation. So I am going to, so by this, d mu phi, I mean phi half phi dot squared minus a half grad phi squared. In other words, I'm using the West Coast metric, where eta mu nu is mostly negative. So unfortunately, about half of the texts and references and papers you'll find studying quantum field theory use this metric, half use the other metric. So there are advantages to both. In this course, we'll stick with this one. But just be aware that many of the, even the references I posted on the wiki, not all of them use this convention. So if we're going to quantize this theory, we're going to be both promoting the field to an operator as well as its conjugate momentum. So remember, the analogous quantity to the position in classical mechanics with a finite number of particles is the field. So if we wanted to consider the quantum mechanics, we'd quantize this operator as well. We promote this quantity to an operator as well as its conjugate momentum. So what we're going to do is promote the field and its conjugate momentum to operators. So in order to do that, we need to find the conjugate momentum to this field, which is just given by the derivative of the Lagrangian respect to phi dot, so that just gives us phi dot. By this equation. And that lets us compute the Hamiltonian. Which, just like the Hamiltonian density, just like in particle mechanics, would be pi times phi dot minus L. And since pi is phi dot, all that happens is we have phi dot squared minus this and minus the rest. We just flip the signs on everything else. And we'll also need to use this Hamiltonian when we quantize the theory. And one last thing we'll need from Lagrangian is the equation of motion. So the equation of motion is dL d phi minus d mu dL d mu phi is 0. This term gives us a minus m squared phi. This term gives us a minus d mu phi. So 0. And we can just as well multiply it by minus 1 and write it as d squared phi, or d squared plus m squared. I can't phi is 0. This is the equation of motion. And we'll come back. Yes.
I just want to understand that that mapping with the number label, the number of particles label, and why it should be like the position label
the Fresnel field?
So what we can imagine is we've got some lattice of particles at each point in space. Say it's a two-dimensional lattice, and the particles are allowed to move in the other direction, in the z direction. There's a lattice on the xy plane. As we take the lattice, it becomes more and more fine-grained. We think about the vertical position of each of those particles at each point on the xy plane. So that's, we have a one, we're associating one number with each point in the xy plane. That position in that direction, we can think about as the value of the field. So that's the analogy we're making. So we can just generalize that to our three-dimensional space-time. So we can imagine field value is corresponds to this displacement, and the label of which particle on the lattice we're talking about corresponds to a position in space-time. Are there some more comments or questions? So we'll come back and solve that equation in a moment. But one other general thing I just want to say a few words about. So we'll come up again throughout this course and in future quantum field theory courses, QFT2 and QFT3. We'll make repeated references back to Noether's theorem. So just want to say a few words about it. We've all seen it in David's course. So Noether's theorem says that for every continuous symmetry, there is a conserved current. And if there's a conserved current, there's also a conserved charge. So continuous symmetry means that the variation of the Lagrangian it doesn't have to be zero. If it's a total derivative, that's good enough. So, and we need the Lagrangian just to change to a total derivative if we have an infinitesimal change in our field. And the reason why we allow the Lagrangian to change up to a total derivative is if there's an total derivative term in the Lagrangian, that doesn't affect the equations of motion. So the equations of motion are the same if there's a total derivative term in the Lagrangian under some infinitesimal transformation of our fields. So that's what it means for there to be a continuous symmetry. Conserved current means that there is some current J whose four divergence vanishes. And the conserved charge is just the integral of the zeroth component of the current. That's conserved. And you can compute the conserved current using Noether's theorem. I'm not going to go through the derivation again. You've seen it a number of times in David's course. The version we'll be using in this course, I'll be using slightly different notation. So we get there's this term. So here y is the variation of the fields. And if the Lagrangian is not invariant, but it instead changes up to a total derivative, that gives us an extra term in the current. And so we'll be using this equation a number of times in this course and future courses. But I just want to give a big warning. So this result is classical. When David derived it, he was using classical physics. I didn't derive it here, but I just want to emphasize that this is a classical result only. It often works in the quantum theory, but it doesn't always. The quantum theory can have anomalies. And that anomaly is basically just the name we give to any effect that breaks Snell's theorem, quantum mechanics. And we'll come back to that in more detail in QFT3. So most of the theories we're going to look at in QFT1 and QFT2 don't have anomalies. So you can show you can compute the divergence of this current in the quantum field theory, and many theories you get zero, and for many symmetries you get zero, but not always. And that's a computation we'll go through in QFT3, but it's an important point conceptually. This is just a classical result. Okay, so that's what I wanted to say about Noether's theorem. There's an example in the notes. I want to solve the Klein-Gordon equation for instead. So let's solve the Klein-Gordon equation. We'll need the solution of the Klein-Gordon equation in order to quantize this theory in a useful form. Okay. The first thing I want to do is I want to perform a three-dimensional Fourier transform of the field. And the reason I'm doing a three-dimensional Fourier transform instead of a four-dimensional Fourier transform is just slightly easier. We could do a four-dimensional Fourier transform. It would just make the derivation a little bit more complicated. You can go through it that way if you want to. But just to save a little bit of work, I'm going to do three-dimensional. And in terms of if we look at the Klein-Gordon equation in terms of the transformed field, so our Klein-Gordon equation is that phi double dot minus d squared phi plus m squared phi is 0. That gives us, in terms of the transformed fields, phi tilde double dot plus k squared plus m squared phi tilde equals 0. So this is an easy equation to solve. The solution are just exponentials. So phi tilde of t and k is some coefficient ak e to the minus I ek t plus some other unknown coefficients e to the I ek t, where ek is root k squared plus m squared. Just a second order differential equation, so we can basically solve it by inspection. And if we want phi to be a real field, then we should have that phi is equal to phi star. And that will impose some constraints on the coefficients a of k and b of k. So phi star of t and x is integral of e to the minus I k dot x and phi star and so in order to compare this to phi, which is just given by this integral with a plus sign here, what we can do is we can take k, the change of variables, k going to minus k, and then phi star becomes the integral of e to the I k dot x phi tilde star of t and minus k. Now, we get three minus signs from the change of variables here. And we also get three minus signs if we put the limits of integration back to where they were originally. So overall, there's two minus signs for each direction in k space. So there's no overall sign. And so that now this integral is in the same form as our integral over here. And we can compare or phi tilde and phi tilde star. And that tells us, so we should have that phi tilde of t and k is equal to phi tilde star of t and minus k, which gives us that b of k should be equal to a star of minus k. So these mode, if we want the field to be real, these mode functions are not independent, but rather this one should be the conjugate of that one. And so if phi is real, we should have this form. And if we look at these exponentials, this exponential already looks nice. We've got, this looks like the components of two forward vectors multiplied by each other. You can write this exponential as e to the minus, e to the plus, that's minus, yeah, minus I k dot x. Where k naught is ek. And over here, it doesn't look quite so nice, but we can do the same thing we did before. If we send k to minus k, the measure doesn't change. We get the same even number of minus signs as before. We'll switch this k to minus k, and we'll flip a sign up here. But e of k is equal to e of minus k, so this term doesn't change. So if we take k to minus k over here, then we can write phi of t and x in a more Lorentz invariant looking way. It'll be useful for us later. So it's starting to look more Lorentz invariant. And the more we can massage this solution now, the easier things will be later. When what we're going to do next time is we're going to promote this to an operator, which means something over here, it's going to have to be promoted to an operator. And that will turn out to be these mode functions, A of K. And these will turn out to be our creation and annihilation operators. And so if we do some more massaging of this equation now, we'll have the nice benefit that our creation and annihilation operators will create Lorentz covariant states, which is a nice property. So it will mean that we won't have to do very much work at all in order to guarantee that our quantum theory behaves properly under Lorentz transformations. And the reason we might expect that this form right now is not so nice for the Lorentz transformation properties of the quantum theory is, well, this measure is manifestly not Lorentz invariant. It only involves three components instead of four. So if we rewrite this in terms of a Lorentz invariant measure, it turns out that the form we'll get will have better Lorentz transformation properties with the other quantum theory. So if we want to write this measure in terms of a Lorentz invariant quantity, the natural starting point is to start instead of with d3k, is to start with d4k. And well, we want to relate this manifestly Lorentz invariant measure to this measure. And well, this is an integration over one more variable. We can eliminate one of the integrations by inserting a delta. And we want to insert a delta that sets k0 to be ek, because in this equation, this is implicitly evaluated at k0 is equal to ek. So if we insert a Lorentz invariant delta function that does that, we can relate our d4k to d3k, and this sets k0 equal to ek. And this is the, we can rewrite this as ek minus 3 vector k, ek squared minus 3 vector k squared minus m squared. And so this will be 0 when ek is k squared plus m squared, like we want. But this has two solutions. There's a solution with ek equal to root k squared plus m squared, but there's also a solution with ek equal to minus root k squared plus m squared. And we can get rid of the other one by throwing in a theta function. Now, this doesn't, on first glance, look Lorentz invariant. It doesn't involve some four-vector square. It just involves some component. But under the proper orthochronous Lorentz transformations, the arrow of time will be preserved. So time reversal is part of the discrete part of the Lorentz group. So if we're only concerned about transformations that preserve the arrow of time, we can insert a factor like this, and it will still be Lorentz invariant. And so this integral is related to the integral we wanted. Can just do the delta integral and get a 1 over 2 ek. And we can write it like that. So this combination is Lorentz invariant. And this should be inside the integral. This combination, this is a Lorentz invariant measure because it's related to this manifestly Lorentz invariant measure. So if we rewrite our field in terms of this measure, that will be a more useful form for quantization. So the form we're going to use starting tomorrow when we quantize the theory is that phi, the solution to the classical Fine-Gordon equation, phi can be written as this integral. And here A is just a rescaled version of big A. And so this is the form we'll use tomorrow. And the advantage of this last step is that these small a's, once we promote them to operators, will create Lorentz covariant states. These big A's would not. Are there some comments or questions? Okay, keep an eye out for the quiz in your email box. You should get that in the next hour or so, and it's due tonight.